Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
There'll be a few people wandering in, so I'll start. Well, Dr. Gerard Henderson, Mrs. Anne Henderson, who's somewhere, thank you. Welcome. She's almost as important as her husband. Many books and editor of the Sydney papers and many other things. Special welcome to Heather Henderson, who we've placed there as our patron, trustee, donor, and of course the daughter of Sir Robert and Dame Menzies. We're delighted to welcome members of the Menzies family, including Diana Menzies, or Mrs. Garrett, Graham Menzies, who's a relative of the trustee as well, and Fiona and Owen Menzies. I have a very distressed phone call from the Honourable Andrew Robb, who's one of our trustees, who's delayed in Canberra and has the frustration of sitting at the airport and would rather be here, as would Michael Johnson. We welcome David Morris, MP, member for Mornington. We have some very distinguished past federal members and ministers, Dame Margaret Guilfoyle, ACDE, the Honourable Peter Nixon, AO, the Honourable Jim Short, the Honourable Tony Staley, who as well as being a minister was, as you know, President of the Liberal Party, Sir David Hay is somewhere, Brian Hocknay, the Federal Director of the Liberal Party, Mr Tony Nutt, State Director, former State Members Ron Wilson, also a trustee and Vice Chairman, Victor Purton, Michael Kroger, Dr John Roscombe, Director of IPA, and our President of the Liberal Club, Dan Hope, who should be sitting there, but he's happy being next to Ron. And how do I describe all of you people? Honourable attendance seem to be the right phrase. It's very special having this lecture in the Legislative Assembly because Sir Robert Menzies was first a Member of Parliament in Victoria. Actually, he spent the first couple of years in the Upper House. Then he was in the Lower House in the 30s and was Deputy Premier. So this is where Menzies also spoke. These lectures commenced in 1978, just during the lifetime of Sir Robert, and they were started at Monash University at a time when viewpoints that were not extreme left were not listened to or tolerated. So a courageous group of students, especially people like Michael Kroger, started this initiative, and here we are over 30 years later with this, the 31st lecture. I think we're proud of our list of lecturers, and it's enhanced today by having Dr. Henderson, and we can recall many stimulating occasions as well as some dangerous moments, and these lectures are still regularly quoted in various writings. We honour our longest serving and great Prime Minister Robert Menzies by sustaining this lecture and having people of substance delivering it. Dr. Gerard Henderson is Executive Director of the Sydney Institute, a Melbourne-educated graduate in Arts and Law and with a doctorate. He's taught at both Tasmanian and Victorian universities. He's worked on the staff of a couple of ministers, Kevin Newman in the Fraser Government Times. He was Chief of Staff to John Howard, 84 to 86, when John Howard was Deputy Leader, then Leader of the Liberal Party. On the invitations and on your ticket returns, I've given details of his career, so I will not go over it. Except to say he's probably an academic, an author, a journalist, a commentator, but a very significant figure. Some people were concerned when they rang me up about his book, Menzies' Child, thinking it was a biography of Heather. Of course, it's one of his great books amongst his many, that is a history of the Liberal Party and the wonderful work that is. His books are on that list and I think you've seen them. He's also well known as a commentator on television, on radio, and his articles are often appear in various journals. Frank Devine said of Gerard Henderson, "He seems incapable of being other than readable on any subject." And I think you'll find he's also incapable of being other than listenable on any subject as well. We're fortunate to have a person whose intellect and quality to give our lecture. In the past, only one of our lectures has been about Menzies himself, Alan Martins, who was Menzies' biographer, and who spoke on one aspect of Menzies' career, his skill as a speaker. Tonight we have a second that looks at Menzies himself. I'm very delighted and honoured for us to have with us tonight Gerard Henderson, and I invite him to give the 2008 Robert Menzies lecture on Why Menzies Matters.
Thanks, Evan, and thanks for all of you for coming along tonight. It's great to see you. Problem with having your CV read out is all your past life that comes before you, and you don't always want to remember it. It is true that I worked for John Howard in 84, 85, and 86, and before that I used to work in the Department of Industrial Relations in Bourke Street in Melbourne, and I'd get off the tram, walk past and Swanson Street and walk past St. Paul's Cathedral and wonder whether anyone in there really believed anything anymore. And further up the street, Melbourne was pretty depressed in those days, as I recall, and you pass the pawn shop, and then you pass another pawn shop, same pronunciation, different spelling, same sort of business. Then around Bourke Street, past the ever-fading portrait of Marilyn Monroe, up into the 8th floor of the Tivoli Court, which was the old site of the old Tivoli, and into the office, working on industrial relations, and I'd written an article on the Industrial Relations Club, which caused a bit of interest at the time, and particularly among my employers who wanted to dismiss me. And life was pretty depressing, I must say. My morale was low, my confidence was sagging, and someone sent me off to an assertiveness course, a morale-boosting course, a confidence-lifting course. It did a bit of good, but I came back after lunch one day after one of these sessions, and I was pretty down, I'll be honest about it. We all down low now about it. We down low about our personal selves, and I was pretty down. If you've got an hour later, I'll go into it. And suddenly the phone rang, and I thought, God, I've got to be assertive. And anyway, the phone rang, and this bloke got on the phone. It was a familiar voice, and said, "Gerard, would you like to come and work with me?" And I said, "Yes. Who's calling?" And that was the start of my career with John Howard. All seems a long time ago now. And the pawn shop's gone, and Melbourne looks prosperous, and it's great to be back. So thanks for the invitation. Robert Gordon Menzies matters as much today as he did both 8 decades ago and 3 decades ago, albeit in different ways. On the Tuesday, the 9th of October 1928, R.G. Menzies was sworn in as a member for ECRA and a Legislative Council in the Parliament of Victoria, here on Spring Street on the 19th of May 1978. The state funeral was held for Sir Robert Menzies at Scots Church, close by on the corner of Russell and Collins Street. And the penultimate chapter is 2-volume Robert Menzies' A Life, which I regard as one of the finest biographies of an Australian Prime Minister. Ellen Martin recorded that, quote, "The state funeral was simple, but touched with great solemnity. Police estimated that 100,000 people lined the route from Melbourne to the Springvale Central Crematorium. There the funeral cortege was met by a lone piper who, to the melancholy strains of the Scottish lament, Flowers of the Forest, led the coffin into the chapel." Now, I very much appreciate the invitation by Ian Gregory, Chairman of the Trust, to give the 30th address to you this evening, and I thank the members of the Trust and also the members of the Monash University Liberal Club who recommended me for this gig. In a phone conversation subsequent to his letter of invitation, Dr. Gregory reminded me that the Trust patron was Mrs. Heather Henderson. So it was impossible to say no. After all, Heather Henderson had launched the first edition of my book, Menzies' Child, the Liberal Party of Australia, in Sydney on the 14th of October 1994, the 50th anniversary of the Liberal Party's formation, to the day and to the hour. And during her address on that occasion, Heather spoke movingly about, and empirically about her father in his capacity as a family man and Australia's longest-serving Prime Minister. Heather and I have stayed in touch with occasional meetings, occasional phone calls, occasional correspondence. She now signs off her letters as Peter Henderson brackets, no relation brackets. And of course she is correct. Now another factor contributing to my acceptance of this invitation turned on my admiration for the Monash University Liberal Club, and this lecture series in particular. As a full-time and part-time student at the University of Melbourne 4 decades ago, I was disappointed by the lack of impact which the Liberal Club at the time had on campus life and on the contemporary debate. This was a common phenomenon around the Australian universities. By the mid-1970s, however, I was pleased to observe that for the first time in many decades, campus liberals had acquired the knowledge and the intellectual ability, along with the courage, to engage the left on university campuses. Without question, the most impressive of this group was the Monash University Liberal Club, with the likes of Michael Kroger in the vanguard. Peter Costello, though not a Liberal Club member, while studying at Monash University, was active in student politics there and worked with Michael Kroger in forming a successful coalition against the extreme left on Australian campuses, which had an impact throughout the country. Also, I admire the importance that the Monash Liberals gave to the spoken and to the written word, demonstrated by the decision made by the likes of Carol Baker and Michael Kroger 3 decades ago to both establish a series of lectures and to print the lectures, and this made possible the publication 10 years ago of Ellen Gregory's edited collection, The Menzies Lectures. And I was also impressed that Michael Kroger directly approached Sir Robert and sought and received his permission to name the series after Sir Robert Menzies. Now, I've come here to talk about Robert Gordon Menzies tonight, but first I should say something about myself and my family to put my position in some kind of perspective. I was born in the Melbourne suburb of Bourwon had been part of the East Yarra province when Menzies was in the Legislative Council. Of course, as we know, he moved into this assembly when he won the seat of Nowari in the November 1929 state election. And Bourwon, of course, was also part of the federal seat of Kooyong, which Menzies represented when I was growing up, along with my sister Veronica and brother Paul at 221 Whitehorse Road, Bourwon. As you well know, Menzies became the member for Kooyong in September 1934 and resigned from politics in January 1966, handing over the seat to Andrew Peacock, who later led the Liberal Party. Kooyong pre-selectors were wont to give younger types a chance. Menzies was 39 when he won, Kooyong, Peacock 27. As it turned out, the Hendersons and the Menzies lived within a block of each other for a couple of years in the late 1940s. In 1948, the Menzies family moved from Howard Street in Kew to Reed Street, Bourwon, just up the hill from Whitehorse Road, where they remained until the house was sold to Robert's brother Frank when the Menzies moved to the lodge in Canberra following the coalition's victory in the 1949 federal election. As a child, I remember riding my tricycle on the footpath outside what we called the Menzies home. Now, Gerard Henderson is an unusual name, since it combines an essentially Catholic first name with an essentially Protestant surname. Put simply, my father, Norman, was the product of what was once called a mixed marriage. It would mean something different today, I suppose. But my paternal grandfather was a Protestant, my paternal grandmother was a Catholic. My father was brought up a Catholic, as was, and my mother, of course, had Catholic parents and was brought up a Catholic, my mother Pauline Darcourt. In the late 40s and early 50s, Norman Henderson was a financial member of both the Clark's Union and the Australian Labor Party. My brother Paul believes that he held office in the ALP's Bourwon branch, and I understand that my mother also voted Labor, as did my aunts, Rita Darcourt and Ellen Darcourt, and my uncle, William Darcourt. And I was close to my aunts and uncle, and they lived nearby in East Kew. My other aunt Eileen had died as a teenager, and my uncle Ellen was killed on the Western Front in November 1917 in the Third Battle of Ypres. My father was an admirer of Labour's wartime Prime Ministers John Curtin and Ben Chifley, but sceptical about Bert Everett, who took over after Chifley died in June 1951. Heather Henderson has spoken of her father's warm relationships with his political opponents Curtin and Chifley. This did not extend to the erratic first Everett. Now, Norman Henderson was part of that tribal Catholic middle class, along with the Catholic working class, who admired their tribal leader, the Irish-born Daniel Mannix, the Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne, who arrived in Australia in 1913. This Catholic tribe attended Mass each Sunday and voted Labour whenever an election was held. And growing up, I was more interested in the activities of the Italian Pope in Rome than the British king or queen in London. It was a different culture. Put simply and diplomatically, as a young boy, it was evident that my family was not a fan of Menzies or the Liberal Party. My sister Veronica recalls that on occasions my mother used disparagingly the term pig iron Bob in political conversation at home. However, my brother has reminded me that the family rejoiced when the Communist Party finished last in Huyong, always losing the deposits of the comrades, most of which was picked up by taking the hat around Moscow, as we later found out. And the Communist Party invariably put up a high profile candidate against Menzies. The lawyer Rex Mortimer scored 1.8% of the primary vote in 1954, and the physician Dr. Gerald O'Day gained 1.2% and 1.1% in 1955 and 1958 respectively. O'Day's faith was especially welcome at our home, since he was once a Catholic who abandoned the faith of our fathers in order to embrace the secular ideology of Lenin and Stalin and to sing their secular anthem, the Internationale. Now, in those days, the Hendersons of Baldwin and the Badagos of East Kew voted Labour 1, the Liberal Party 2, and the Communist Party last. And at an early age, I learned one of Norman Henderson's political jokes, which went, question, what's the difference between Australia and America? Answer, America has been crossing in Bob Hope, and Australia has Bob Menzies and no Hope. As a young boy, I loved helping or pretending to help my father and my siblings letterbox OLP material in the Commonwealth and state elections in the early 50s, and I remember admiring my father as he handed out ALP How to Vote cards opposite the Deep Dean Park on Whitehorse Road. And then after Labor's loss to the Coalition in May 1954, Ebert turned on the anti-communist and the ALP's Victorian branch, many of whom were Catholics, and also publicly attacked Dr. Mannix and later the Catholic lay activist B.A. Santa Maria. And this, of course, was the beginning of the Labor split, which commenced in late 1954 and concluded 3 years later in Queensland in 1957. And my father, along with thousands of other anti-communist rank-and-file members, were expelled from the ALP and later withdrew its support from the anti-communist and the ALP industrial groups. At the May 1955 Victorian election, the December 1955 federal election, I helped or pretended to help my father and my siblings distribute flyers to the newly formed anti-communist Labour Party, which later became the Democratic Labour Party. So in 1955 and subsequently, my father put Bob Menzies ahead of what he called the Evan Labour Party in the seat of Huyong, and my parents remained in Huyong for the rest of their lives, and my father went on to distribute How to Vote cards for the Democratic Labour Party. Now, as a matter of record, the DLP preferences saved the Menzies coalition from defeat at the 1961 federal election, and the John Gordon-led coalition from defeat in 1969. Menzies understood the significance of what had occurred. Gordon never did. And Formal went on to win yet another victory in 1963 before retiring. The latter lost his leadership, as we know, in party room ballot to the poorly performing William McMahon, who lost to Gough Whitlam in the 1972 election. Now, I think there are two great and honourable political traditions in Australia, the social democrat tradition and the politically conservative tradition. And up to the Labor split, the Hendersons of Baldwin belonged to the former. The Menzies, of course, belonged to that other tradition. But what they had in common was both traditions opposed the extremes of left and right, both opposed fascism and Nazism, and also communism. And just as Menzies admired Curtin and Chifley, even though he disagreed with them on many matters, so my family came to admire Menzies, even if they did not completely agree with him on all matters. And after all, there was much to admire. And I note that Andrew Robb, who of course played a significant role in the Liberal Party victory in 1996, and is now the most senior Liberal in Victoria, has a very similar background. He also helped his family hand out DLP How to Vote cards in Epping and Labour Reservoir. And Frank Robb, like Norman Henderson, was a social democrat by instinct, but they moved away from Labour because they could not accept the social agenda and the foreign policy agenda of elitism and Whitlamism. Australians tend not to be a flag-waving crowd or very emotive, so the fact that some 100,000 people turned out in the Melbourne CBD to pay, and in the suburbs, to pay their tribute to Menzies after he died at the age of 83 provides an indication of the respect with which he was held by many. And as we know, Menzies became Prime Minister after Joseph Lyon died in office in April 1939, and by and large, both men have been treated with undue harshness by Australian historians and commentators. And Henderson has done much to reassess Lyons in her contribution to Michelle Grattan's book, Australian Prime Ministers, with her entry in the British Dictionary of National Biography and her recent book on Enid Lyons. And I'm proud of the fact that I played a part in reassessing Robert Menzies' reputation in my weekly newspaper column, in electronic media appearances, and in my book, Marriage of Menzies' Child. But of course, no one did more to give Menzies his due than the late Ellen Martin, his two-volume biography. And what was significant here, I think, of Ellen Martin is that he was a self-declared Labour voter until quite late in his life. And I think his book gets greater credibility for the fact that he does come from the social democratic tradition in Australia, and Ellen addressed the Sydney Institute on a couple of his occasions and his speeches are by our bound journal, the Sydney Institute. Now, it's scarcely surprising that Joe Lyons received bad press despite his achievement when acting treasurer and ensuring, with the active support of the young Victorian MP in this chamber, R.G. Menzies, and ensuring Australia did not default on its loans in the early 1930s. But we know why Lyons wasn't liked. He won three elections and he left the Labour Party. And Menzies was much the same. He wasn't liked, essentially because he ended up winning lots of elections too. But of course, as we know, he only narrowly retained office in 1940, and he failed to win in 1946, which was only defeated the ballot box. But of course, he prevailed from late 49 until early 66. Heather Henderson commended a letter published in Quadrant last April, in which she made the case that her father was Australia's greatest Prime Minister, that Sir Robert had the wit to know when to go. Not only did Menzies retire at a time of his own choosing, he also provided the opportunity for his successor, Harold Holt, to renew and refresh the Liberal Party in the lead up to the December 1966 election, in which the Coalition scored a record victory. The proposition that Menzies matters is self-evident from the attempts by the left to discredit him and his period in office and to diminish his legacy both in retirement and in death. And this was led by the most influential historian, Manning Clark. In the epilogue to the sixth and final volume of his A History of Australia, Manning Clark wrote with approval of the various Labour leaders. Jim Scullin was much loved. John Curtin was greatly loved. Ben Chifley was simply loved. Bert Evatt had the image of Christ in his heart and believed Labour was the magic flute leading Australians from ignorance and superstition up to the light. Gough Whitlam was, quote, a man of vision who attempted to liberate Australians from the dead hand of the past. And so Manning Clark went on. And what about R.G. Menzies? Well, according to Clark, Menzies' life was a tragedy writ large, since he lacked the one precious gift of reading the direction of the river of life. What's more, Clark maintained that Menzies may have tasted deep damnation as the fruit of his disquiet, and wait for it, he was not loved. Now, this approach to history as barracking for left-wing causes has influenced many Australians' contemporary historians who commented on R.G. Menzies and the Liberal Party of Australia. Michael McKernan was a bit ahead of me at school, but we shared the same history teacher, Jim Griffin, and I was a student at Melbourne University with Judith Brett, David Day, and Stuart McIntyre, and all four were very bright, able students who subsequently have made a significant contribution in their various capacities as historian, commentator, teacher. And all four, plus John Edwards, have delivered fine addresses at the Sydney Institute in recent years. But what they share in common is a sense of contempt for Menzies, and the question is, what was this and what is this all about? Now, in an article which he wrote in a magazine called Voices, Stuart McIntyre spoke for his generation and simply said that he couldn't bear the ageing anachronism of Menzies and his provincial Philistinism. And he said that this was a generational reading of Menzies, and it was a generation to both which he and Judith Brett belonged. But I belong to the same generation, and I never felt that. And of course, this helps explain Menzies' hostility, McIntyre's hostility to Menzies in his many histories. In A Concise History of Australia, Professor McIntyre wrote that Menzies was a man out of sympathy with his times. But that's not what the electorate said, because he wouldn't have won 7 elections in a row if he was a man out of sympathy with his times. In her book, Robert Menzies' Forgotten People, Judith Brett tried to take Menzies seriously, but on occasions could not escape what McIntyre depicts as a general generational reading of Menzies' alleged anachronism. In one of the most ridiculous paragraphs written in Australian political history, and it's got a few rivals, Brett depicts Menzies' opposition to communism as a homophobic-induced fear of attack from behind. Let's go to the text of page 87, and I quote, "Much anti-communist rhetoric has drawn on bodily images, the imagery of sickness and disease, the social cancer, and the anal erotic imagery of the attack from behind, rooting rats out of holes. There are occasional uses of such imagery by mainstream Australian non-Labor politicians like Menzies, but they are surprisingly few." So in a rush to Freudian analysis, Dr. Brett overlooked the obvious, namely that Menzies was opposed to communism because it enshrined what Ronald Reagan later termed the evil empire. The prisoners in the various communist gulags well understood this, as did the descendants of the victims of Lenin, Stalin, Mao, and the others. But such wisdom was not gained by the likes of Brett or McIntyre. Now, as I mentioned in this Voices article, McIntyre bagged Menzies' alleged anachronism. But it seems to me that anachronism, like beauty, lies in the eye of the beholder. After leaving Melbourne University, Stuart McIntyre signed on as a member of the Communist Party, and Judith Brett went on to sign on as an editor of Arena magazine, a self-declared journal of left opinion, which remains the house journal of many continuing Marxists even to today. So to me, such life choices seem somewhat anachronistic, but then maybe I've got that wrong. I think it says a lot about Menzies and his legacy that he's been able to withstand this kind of criticism. I just want to cover a few areas where I think the criticism is being unfair. For example, in his book, The Strength of a Nation, Michael McKernan writes of Menzies' support for Neville Chamberlain's policy of appeasement towards Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany in 1938 and 1939. And he juxtaposes Menzies' experiences in Germany when he visited there in July 1938 with those of the left-wing historian Manny Clark, who visited Germany in late 1938. Dr. McKernan contrasted Manny Clark's first-hand report of what he saw in Bonn on the morning after Kristallnacht with Robert Menzies' speech to the Melbourne Grammar Old Boys a few days later, and needless to say, comparison is not favourable to Menzies. Ronald Reagan once joked that some of his clearest memories turned out to be of events which had never taken place. We now know that Manny Clark was not in Bonn on the morning after Kristallnacht. He simply made it up by reporting his fiancée's infamous personal recollections as his own. So we now have to assess a lot of Manny Clark's personal recollections, because if you can report something where you're not at, you can report other things which you're not at. But there is an important point here. Sure, Menzies was an appeaser in the late 1930s. So was Joe Scullin. So was the Labour leader, John Kirkwood. And so were the overwhelming majority of Australian politicians, with the notable exception of William Morris Hughes. Moreover, as Alan Martin has documented, the term "pig iron bog," which was applied to Menzies, was unfair, since in the late 1930s all members of the League of Nations were trading with Japan, and neither John Curtin nor anyone else in the Labour opposition criticised his policy at the time. However, the fact is that when Mr Chamberlain came to his senses and Britain declared war on Germany, Menzies joined the leaders of Britain, Canada, New Zealand and some other nations in putting on the khaki in support of king and country. And on the 3rd of September 1939, speaking as Prime Minister, Menzies said that it was his melancholy duty to declare that, consequent upon Germany's invasion of Poland, Australia was at war with Germany. Now this stands in stark contrast to many of Manny Clark's comrades on the left at the time. The inconvenient truth is that when Menzies declared war on Germany in 1939, the Communist Party and its fellow travellers in the Labour Party and in the trade union movement. I'm not saying that's all of them, but that was some. They supported Nazi Germany as a consequence of their backing of the notorious Nazi-Soviet Pact of August 1939. And this lot included the likes of Mr. Mortimer and Dr. O'Day. And the pro-communist left continues to oppose the Allied war effort and continued to do so until July 1941, when Germany invaded the Soviet Union. Yes, Menzies was an appeaser in 1938, but he became a warrior in 1939. Unlike the pro-communist left, which effectively collaborated with the Nazis during the first 2 years of the Second World War, which is why the Menzies government in that period banned the Communist Party. And this is something which is seldom dwelt on in, say, the Stuart MacIntyre history. Indeed, the impact of the Nazi-Soviet Pact in Australia does not raise one mention in either MacIntyre's Concise History of Australia or the Oxford History of Australia, 1901 to 1942. And what about the Social Democrats? Michael McKernan has referred to John Curtin as, quote, the father of the nation during the Second World War. Yet it should be remembered that when he was opposition leader at the commencement of World War II, Curtin opposed the deployment of the Australian Imperial Force to fight Hitlerism, maintaining that it should stay at home to defend Australia. And the truth is that in September 1939, Labor was not prepared to do anything to defeat Nazism in Europe or in North Africa. Now, the left and the Social Democrats are invariably better at writing and rewriting history than the political conservatives. On the 19th of April 2001, John Edwards delivered the John Curtin Prime Ministerial Library Public Lecture in Perth at Curtin University. An early copy of his speech was given to selected media outlets, and the ABC AM program revealed, quote, the discovery of a letter, unquote, sent by Menzies to Stanley Lord and Bruce, a High Commissioner in London, in September 1939. And the ABC ran John Edwards' line that Menzies was, quote, an appeaser even after the war began. But this overlooked the obvious point that appeasers don't declare war. I was interviewed on AM The World Today that morning and introduced by the latter programme. I was introduced on The World Today as, quote, one of the chief safeguarders of the Bob Menzies legacy. That night at late notice, I was invited to debate the matter with Dr. Edwards on the Late Line programme. And there I was able to remind viewers that this so-called new evidence, this brand new discovery, had actually been published as long ago as 1976 in a bound volume put out by the Department of Foreign Affairs during the time of Malcolm Fraser's government. Nothing had been discovered by Edwards or anyone else. And the same evening, Paul Keating rushed into the debate by talking to Philip Adams on Late Night Live, and Mr. Keating accused Menzies of being, quote, one of a group of craven cowards who wanted to lie down when the fight was really on. But Edwards did not tell his audience, and Keating failed to inform Philip Adams, listeners, that in Australia in September 1939, only the left did not want to combat Nazism when the fight was really on. Needless to say, Mr. Adams didn't bother to correct Mr. Keating's bad history, or to mention that his guest hero, Jack Lang in Sydney, did not want to take on Nazism at any time during 1939 or 1940. And then there's David Day, whose book Menzies and Churchill at War is centred around a documentary form on ABC TV. In this term, Dr. Day alleged that Menzies was willing to quit Australia, to vacate Australia, in the early years of World War II and settle in Britain, where he hoped to succeed Winston Churchill as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And what's the evidence for this? Well, as Alan Martin documented, it consists of a minute, which Menzies probably did not read, in which Menzies' admirer theorised that it would be a U-Butte idea if his hero took over at 10 Downing Street. And Dr. Day's account of this non-event is replete with such telltale words and concepts as presumably, it seems, suggest, and wait for it, even Trojan horse. Now, Paul Hasmark, Australia's official war historian for political events during the Second World War, was in as good a position as anyone to assess the relative merits of Menzies and Curtin, and he did so in his 1979 Daniel Mannix Memorial Lecture, and he concluded by saying that both Menzies and Curtin can claim credit as wartime prime ministers. Menzies did a lot in the first 2 years, and Curtin did a lot after that. Despite Menzies' willingness to commit Australians to war against fascists in 1939, some of Menzies' detractors like to present him as a fascist or neo-fascist or something like that. Take, for example, the work of academic Andrew Moore, in particular his book The Right Road, A History of Right-Wing Politics in Australia, where the following statement appears, and I quote, "It might sound melodramatic to suggest that in 1951 Australian fascism's headquarters were in the Lodge, Canberra, but that is not very far from the truth," unquote. Now, Dr. Moore's analysis is not even good. Melodrama, just bad, undocumented history. Menzies did not even encourage the Australian homegrown Boona Wright, and certainly not real fascists. Malcolm Fraser has recorded that. When he was a young Liberal MP in the 1950s, Menzies advised him to have nothing whatsoever to do with the anti-Semitic Eric Butler and the Australian Legal Rights Organisation, which Butler ran. To even hint that Menzies' home was the headquarters of Australian fascism in 1951 is culminating. Yet this sort of historical dribble, which is being taught at taxpayers' expense to young Australians undertaking tertiary studies by those who seek to sneer at and attempt to diminish Menzies' memory, and it continues. Now, when the libertarian left begins to demand the alleged lack of morality among political conservatives, it is evident that there's a political play involved. A recent example occurred when the comedian and Sunday Age columnist, and they're not necessarily the same thing, and one time arena editor Guy Rundle attacked the moral standards of Sarah Palin's pregnant daughter, Bristol. Writing in Crikey, Rundle sneered, and I quote, "John McCain has a face that says, yes, some Sue just said earlier at the Republican Party function. Yeah, do," comments Rundle, "but sadly so does Bristol Palin." Now, it's interesting to see how some leftist libertarians become born-again moralisers when there's a prospect of criticising a political conservative or members of his or her family. In November 2006, Mungo McCallum contributed a leading article in The Monthly, editorial chairman Professor Robert Mann and editor Sally Warhaft, in which McCallum wrote, and I quote, "When Sir Warwick Fairfax belatedly discovered that his first wife had conducted an affair with Menzies, the Sydney Morning Herald had a rather less passionate affair with Menzies' opponent, Arthur Paul." Now, this is not the first occasion on which McCallum has run this rumour about Menzies and the late Mrs. Warwick, Betty Fairfax. He had given it a mention in an article which was published in The Age in July 2002. It's just that on this occasion I was rung by Crikey and asked what was the evidence of this allegation, and I replied, "None whatsoever, absolutely none," and drew Crikey's attention to page 302 of Alan Martin's first volume, where the only extant evidence was published about the friendship circa 1938, which was a letter, a friendly note in which Mr. Menzies said that he might invite himself around for a drink with the latter after he returned to Australia from a visit to Europe. That's it. Now, I advised Ketchell that I'd spoken, Mr. Ketchell from Crikey, that I'd spoken to Robert Martin about this matter, and Martin advised me there was no evidence of any kind to support this rumour. I also made the point that if the rumour had been true, it's most unlikely that so perceptive a person as Robert Menzies would have left a copy of even such an innocuous letter in his personal papers. Crikey went back to Warhaft and asked her what fact-checking the Monthly Inc. undertook before publishing Mungo McCallum's claim. Sally Warhaft's reply is instructive, and I quote, she said, "I spoke to Mungo," that is Mungo McCallum, "I spoke to Mungo about this. When I first read the rumour, I said I felt very uneasy about it. He said he talked to a lot of people and it was common knowledge, and he'd published it before. I accepted Mungo's insistence that his sources were strong." Now, it seems that Professor Mann presides over an influential journal of opinion where so-called fact-checking merely involves an editor ringing up a contributor and asking about his or her sources, and is satisfied when the alleged evidence is attributed to that ubiquitous phrase, common knowledge. Now, pressured by Crikey, McCallum put forward his evidence. It consisted of his recalled stories told to him many years ago by unnamed politicians, unnamed political staffers, two deceased journalists, and some anonymous deceased Commonwealth car drivers. And in the follow-up discussion, the rumour was dismissed by, among others, historians Gavin Supen, Richard Griffin Foley, and the journalist Vic Carroll, Gideon Haig, and Brian Johns. Eventually, McCullum conceded the crime, that there was no direct evidence for his claim that the relationship was more than just a platonic friendship, but it's never been corrected. The Liberal Party does not take its history as seriously as it should, and I think there's a good case that the prehistory of the Liberal Party, that period from Federation to 1944, should be more regularly recorded, the period when the conservative side of politics, under the various names of the Protectionist Party, the Free Trade Party, the fusion between the two, the Nationalist Party, the United Australia Party, which were led by the likes of Edmund Barton, Alfred Deakin, George Read, Joseph Cook, William Morris Hughes, Danny Norton Bruce, John Latham, the former member of QOM, Joseph Lyons, and of course Robert Menzies. I think that should be recorded. I noted in its recent pamphlet, 60 Years of Achievement in Australia, the Liberal Party has recorded that. I think there's a case for putting miniature photographs of these leaders on the party room wall in Canberra, where it would give the prehistory of the Liberal Party, because it did have a prehistory. But the history changed in 1944. And Menzies, of course, was a politician who experienced failure along with acute disappointment and in prevail. Now, of course, I think it's fair to say that he mishandled the politics of the UAP at the time, during the beginning of the Second World War, so much so that he lost the support of his colleagues and felt the need to step down in favour of Arthur Fallon, the Country Party leader. And he also performed poorly in the 1940 election when he failed to win a majority of seats, but was returned as Prime Minister. But as we know, he fought back and he managed to bring the disparate forces of political conservatism together. And the story has been told by Menzies in his book Afternoon in Life, been told by Alan Martin, by Graham Starr in his documents, The Liberal Party of Australia, Documentary History, by myself and others. However, many of Menzies' critics do not even acknowledge his success in forming the Liberal Party. Take Judith Brett, for example, and the introduction to the new edition of the book, Robert Menzies' Forgotten People. She challenges the view that the Liberal Party could be called Menzies' child, because she makes the point that he didn't really found it, he was just one of many, and it's a myth to maintain otherwise. Now, of course, all of us who've written on the Liberal Party acknowledge the men and women who formed the Liberal Party and the various organisations from which they came. And I make the point, men and women, seriously, because Robert Menzies himself paid tribute to the key role played by Mrs. May Couchman and the Australian Women's National League in Victoria in the formation of the party. But I think the essential point is that no one except Menzies had the political ability, the charisma or the intellectual clout to merge these organisations at the time. And that's why it's fair to call the Liberal Party Menzies' child. And it's noteworthy that in recent email correspondence, Dr. Brett seems to be walking away from this position. I sent her a note on the 7th of April and I said, finally, I asked you the same question as I asked Ian Hancock in 1995. Do you believe that the Liberal Party would have been founded around 1944 without Robert Menzies? Professor Hancock has conceded that the correct answer to this question is in the negative. What do you think? Was my question to Professor Brett, and shortly after the reply, the entire reply came back and said, "Dear Gerard, I've noted your views, best Judy." Now, I suggest that Dr. Brett declined to answer this crucial question because a truthful answer is inconsistent with the theory that the statement that Menzies founded the Liberal Party is but a myth. Now, in democratic politics and in governance, you here know very well, being experienced in this area. In this area, in democratic government, the real achievers are those who create sustainable institutions or who implement sustainable change. And his long political career, Menzies, accompanied much, but without question, one of his great achievements was to create the Liberal Party of Australia in 1944 out of the remnants of those politically conservative parties and organisations which existed in the early 1940s and which had performed disastrously under the leadership of Fallon and Hughes in the 1943 federal election. Menzies' achievement is no more evident than in these periods like today, when the Liberal Party is out of favour in the electorate. In 1993, during one of these earlier periods, Judith Brett wrote that, quote, "The Liberal Party in the 1990s seemed doomed," but it wasn't. Recently, the academic Norman of Jorgensen has predicted that the coalition lost the last election, the Liberal Party would be extremely fortunate to survive in its present state, but it has survived. All such prophecies prove false, which stands as testimony to the structure which Menzies created in 1944. And following the victory of the Liberals in the recent Western Australian election and some by-election successes in New South Wales and a good showing in the Gippsland by-election here in Victoria, no new soothsayers have emerged in recent times to foretell the Liberal Party's imminent death. Menzies child, like the significantly older Labor Party, both Labor and the Liberal Party formed in 1944 proved to be enduring in the face of difficulties. And Malcolm Turnbull is capable of reviving the Liberal Party at the federal level because the organisation which Menzies founded in 1944 was built to last in bad times as well as in good times. And likewise, the present Labor government is able to take initiatives in the current international financial crisis because of what they inherited from the economic legacy of Peter Costello and John Howard, not only in a large budget surplus, but also no net Commonwealth debt. In other words, in all these matters, inheritance counts. Now, contrary to what ABC journalists, some ABC journalists say, I do not consider myself to be one of the chief safeguardians of Menzies' legacy. Kevin Henderson fulfill such a role with considerable ability and doesn't need any relief from an interchange bench. However, I've been motivated to some extent to get into this argument because of what I regard as the unfair treatment of Menzies by historians and commentators. Now, there is reason, of course, to criticise and query some of Menzies' policies. Paul has not acknowledged Menzies' strong respect for tradition was such that he did not do much that was wrong and was slow to do anything that was novel. For the most part, Menzies presided over a growing economy with low interest rates, low inflation and low unemployment. I think Menzies could have done something to overturn what in 1990 I termed the Federation Trifecta, the legacy left by Alfred Deakin and Labor of high levels of protection, highly centralised industrial relations and white Australia. It was dismantled, but not fully until the governments of Bob Hawke and Paul Keating and subsequently John Howard with the support of Peter Costello. But that was something that Menzies could have done, but on the other hand, the Australian economy during all of his period was very strong. There was probably reason, there was obviously understandable reason why people didn't feel the need to act. I also think that whilst he was a Federalist, Menzies could have done more to insert Commonwealth power with respect to Aborigines, but this was put in place by Harold Holt soon after Menzies stepped down. And on issues like white Australia, it's fair also to recall that Menzies, a man born in 1894, was a man of his generation. At the time, during Menzies' period, only two parties opposed the white Australia policy, the Communist Party and the Democratic Labour Party, which was an unusual unity ticket to the shore. And I think the Menzies government, and here I include such senior ministers as Holt and Haslack, could have done more to explain Australia's commitment to Vietnam. But again, Menzies must bear some responsibility of this, despite his advancing age. But these are fairly minor quibbles. All governments commit sins of commission and omission, and this they reflect humanity. Yet, on any objective standards, Robert Menzies presided over a successful administration which ensured the security of Australians and facilitated rising living standards. In his book, The Lucky Country, Donald Horne complained that Australia was a lucky country run by second-rate people. But Australia was very successful in 1964, and it remains so today, and that couldn't have happened if Australia had been run by second-rate people. Today, it's fashionable in some circles to present Menzies as something which he was not. That is, some kind of smaller liberal who would feel comfortable in, say, the British Liberal Democrats. This is ahistorical. Some leading liberals today could well learn from the Liberal Party founder, who understood the need to continue to appeal to political, social and economic conservatives, and who recognised that the Liberal Party would never succeed in the long term by flirting with the left or left-wing causes. Now, whether Australians agreed with Menzies or not, they invariably understood where he stood on the important social issues, on foreign policy issues as well. And I'll conclude by making a few brief points. Menzies believed in the family as the most important institution of society. His government's policies reflected that. That was sound policy. Menzies believed in the importance of private enterprise. He opposed what was then fashionable in his time, in his early times, the nationalisation of the private industry by compulsory acquisition and imposed cradle to grave welfare. That's been demonstrated to be true, that other nations, Britain and New Zealand, went a different way, and therefore the task of coming back was much more difficult. Menzies believed in national security, hence Australia's commitments in support of the US and Britain in Korea, the British and the Malayan emergency and confrontation, the Americans in Vietnam. But he took these decisions because he thought these commitments were in the national interest of Australia, as well as being consistent with Australia's treaty obligations. On national security, Menzies sought to ban the Communist Party of Australia in the early 1950s when, as is now proven, it was an agent of the Comintern in Moscow and of the various dictatorships in Moscow. The Menzies government also introduced tough minded amendments to the Crimes Act in the early 1960s, which upset the pro-communist left and the civil liberties lobby of the day. And justification for the Menzies government's approach can be found in the book What's Left, written by the one-time Communist Party functionary Eric Ahrens, who admitted on page 118 that if the Communist Party had been in power in Australia in the 1950s, it would have been executing people. And Australians were entitled to be protected from such revolutionaries, and Menzies understood this. And they believed in economic growth and in high levels of immigration. Whilst initially distrustful of Catholics at a personal level, that didn't remain all his life. Menzies was the first Australian political leader, Catholic or Protestant, to resolve the legitimate claim by Catholics that their school should receive government support, state aid as it was called. At the time, Catholics of Irish and Italian stock comprised the most significant minority in Australia. My Catholic family rejoiced in this breakthrough in the lead up to the 1963 election, Menzies' last, and it was reflected in his great victory in the end of 1963, which led on to his voluntary retirement from office. The one real grievance which my parents and my aunts and uncles felt was taken away by an initiative of the Menzies government. So for obvious reasons, my family came to admire Robert Menzies, and as I said, there was good reason to. And if you look back on it, Menzies presided over an accepting society with near zero levels of ethnic motivated crime and very high levels of intermarriage between ethnic groups. Australia was a successful multicultural country in the 1950s and 60s before anyone thought of the term. In his important book, The Costello Memoirs, Peter Costello graciously writes that, with the possible exception of Sir Robert Menzies, John Howard is Australia's greatest Prime Minister. Kevin Rudd also understands the importance of Menzies' legacy. In the lead up to the 2007 election, our current Prime Minister sought to identify with Sir Robert on at least two occasions. The respect held by many mainstream social democrats, like Mr. Rudd, for Menzies, along with the continuing hatred of Menzies by the far left, within the universities and within sections of the media, tells us why Robert Gordon Menzies remained so important three decades after his death, and why it is necessary that the Monash Liberal Club and the Sir Robert Menzies Lecture Trust continue to remember R.G. Menzies and this function each year, and why Menzies still matters both to the Liberal Party of Australia and to our nation. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan, and thank you, Jared, for that. What we'd all agree would be a very informative and fantastic lecture. I'm sure everyone in this here has a lot to think about tonight. I'm glad that you acknowledged at the beginning of your speech the political activism for our West of the Monash University Liberal Club. I'd just like to remind you that, you know, compared to other Liberal Clubs, we still retain that position as the best for Liberal Club. I haven't offended anyone here. A lot in that speech. There's a lot that, you know, we can gain from you having lived through the times and experienced the political debates up close. It's something that we in the younger generations, unfortunately, haven't had the privileged to experience, or maybe we're privileged having not experienced it, I don't know. But I think that's one of the reasons why that this lecture, like you said, is important. It does remind us that we do have a legacy in the Liberal Party which we need to maintain, something which we can look to in times of, I won't say crisis, but in times of internal self-questioning, where we may be out of government in states and territories and looking to redefine ourselves as Liberals. I think that Menzies does present a figure which we can look to internally, that where we can look to see where we should go from here. And unfortunately, Menzies' legacy is not being discussed, and Menzies' legacy is treated with disdain in the media. So I think that's why this event is so important that we hold annually. I'd just like to say that with reference to Menzies' alleged protectionism, it's often not remembered that the economic environment that Australia was going through in this period was a much more insular and inward-looking environment. We had a major trading partner in the case of the UK. We didn't have the imperatives of globalisation to the same extent that we do today, and you know the need to be interconnected in the world economies. As such, I guess it's understandable that considering that economic rationalism hadn't taken root yet in Western economies, that it's unfair, I think, for people to levy the charge of protectionist against Menzies, and I'm glad that you covered that in your speech, Jared. I think in Menzies we have a fantastic legacy, a legacy that has served us well, a legacy that we can look to, and a legacy that we can we can utilise in the future. And I think, especially considering Menzies' service in this place, here in the Legislative Assembly, I think it's incredibly poignant way to be talking about this. So thank you again, Jared, for your discussion of this, and thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you very much, Dan. I'll now call on Mrs. Heather Henderson.
Just in case you haven't had enough speeches tonight, and as you know, it's impossible for me to stand and just say three words. And Gerard, no relation to Gerard Henderson, talked about my inheritance. And yes, indeed, I'm extremely proud of it. I myself have done nothing, but I can talk about the father with some authority. Mr. Keeping used to refer to the Rip Van Winkle years when my father was Prime Minister. So it's very nice to have heard some of the things that he did do. And he was not asleep, I can assure you. It interests me that these days not a week goes by without his name appearing somewhere in the press or somewhere. Sometimes not very kindly, but nevertheless, he is remembered. He is remembered, I think, almost probably more than any other Prime Minister in Australia. There was an article in the leading article in yesterday's Australian which quoted him. There was an article in this morning's Canberra Times which quoted him not very kindly. So I immediately sat in the plane coming down writing a letter about it. It was somebody who said that Menzies decided against volunteering to fight in the First World War. Well, and I might have told you this before, there was a big family conference in the Menzies family, and it was decided that his older brothers, Les and Frank, would go to the war, and Bob would stay home and study and work, so he was able to look after the family. And I've since been told that this happened in many families. One son was kept home to look after the family. But I can tell you, he suffered from it for the rest of his life. He had to put up with people jeering, criticising publicly, everything else. But he always felt he could never answer, never explain why he didn't go to the war. But at the end of the war, he said to his sister, "I was not allowed to go to the war, so I will devote my life to Australia." And aren't we lucky that he did? I think he would have been a hopeless soldier anyway, so he was much better employed doing what he did. I just have to tell you one little story, that you were saying they should have photos of the Liberal leaders, or the, whatever you call them, non-Labour leaders. A friend of mine had an American friend, went into the Liberal Party headquarters one day, and she was not familiar with Australia or Australian politicians, and she looked at the wall and looked at that photo and said, "Why do you have a photo of Sir Eric Pearce on the wall?" Gerard, thanks for coming. There's one other thing I have to tell you. When you talked about respect for my father from people who didn't vote for him. We came back from an overseas post once, and the carpet man, Mr. Kelly, came to fix the carpet. And he said, "I never agreed with a thing your father ever said, but by God, I wish we had him now." And his colleague said, "I always thought he was a communist." So that was typical, I think. It happens again and again. And somebody knocked on the door a couple of weeks ago and said, "I have a photo of your father that you haven't got." And he was a man who worked in Parliament House, and he was a painter. And he was there the day my father announced his retirement. And he got a photo of him with the car behind. And he was very proud of it, and he gave me the photo. And then on the anniversary of my father's death, he sent me an email saying something about that wonderful man. So it keeps coming. It's wonderful. And for me, fantastic. And Gerard, thank you for that. And we, as a present from the Liberal Club, to say thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I thought we ought to follow in the Menzies way, so we went last night to a drink at the Savage Club, or I think it was one, it might have been two, and then we're staying at the Menzies suite at the Windsor Hotel, so I reckon if we get home tonight, fill that up with scotch and empty it, I reckon we'll be living in the tradition. Well, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Gerard Henderson. Superb. I think it probably would be martini you could have left with rather than scotch. Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for your wonderful support, and I'm glad you were here for a truly memorable lecture. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.